The gospel reading this morning comes from the gospel according to John. We're going to be reading from chapter 18, verses 1 through 14. Hear the word of the Lord. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I've lost not one." Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
You're visiting with us this morning. For many, many weeks, we've been covering the five chapters of the disciples in that upper room from chapters 13 through 17. And we finished last week in a glorious way. The Lord just came down and mightily blessed us in that entire worship. And as we closed out that part of his word, we come now. They've left the upper room, and we come to the time of Jesus' passion, when he goes through a horrific ordeal over chapters 18 and 19. And for the next few weeks, that will be our focus. Who is in charge here? That's the question before the house this morning as we look at this passage. But we'll begin back with John 1. Where does the Apostle John begin his gospel? The other gospel writers begin here on earth in their record. However, John begins in heaven with the Son of God. In his gospel, Matthew and Luke begin with the miraculous virgin birth here. John, he's off in heaven writing about what is happening. You know the words, verse 1 of chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then there is that astounding announcement that changed the history of the world in verse 14. And that Word became flesh and dwelt among us. If you compare the Gospels, Matthew, the theme of Matthew's Gospel is Jesus, the Messiah, the King of Israel. The theme of Luke's gospel is Jesus, the Son of Man and Savior of the world. The theme of John's gospel is the Son of God incarnate, the Son of God in the flesh. Now, why am I mentioning this at the beginning of chapter 18? Because on every page of John's gospel, Jesus is proclaimed the Son of God. In fact, we've seen it over and over again in our study. We've probably looked at that verse 50 times where John says, "The purpose of my writing this gospel is that you might believe that he is the Son of God." And so it's on every page. And we will see it clearly in John 18 and 19. Why is that so important? Because these two chapters, where we begin this morning, record Jesus' betrayal, his arrest, his trial, his torture, his crucifixion. In all of those events, it's easy to think of Jesus as a victim of the Sanhedrin's power and of Rome's power. Through our human eyes, in those chapters, he seems to be caught in a torrential flood of violent hatred. In fact, Albert Schweitzer, in his 1906 book, Quest for the Historical Jesus, surmised that Jesus was a mere man. This is what Schweitzer believed. That Jesus was just a mere man who had a messianic complex and died a disillusioned lunatic on a Roman cross. He writes that Jesus believed himself to be the Messiah and that he took hold of the wheel of history to bring a spiritual change. But when Jesus tried to turn that wheel, it refuses to turn. In fact, let me quote him. It refuses to turn and crushes him. The wheel rose onward, and the mangled body of one immeasurably great man is hanging upon it still. End quote. In other words, Jesus' hopes and aspirations were crushed in the powerful, grinding gears of the governments of Israel and Rome. That's what Schweitzer said. Now, he did not find that idea. He didn't find those ideas in the Gospels. And he especially did not find it in John's Gospel. People, Jesus is not pictured as a victim in any or in all of these horrific events of John 18 and 19. So first, let's look at his arrest. I want you to see this morning, as we look at this passage, that Jesus determined the time and place of his arrest. Earlier that evening, in the upper room, Jesus had identified Judas Iscariot as the traitor. He had immediately dismissed him to get about his treacherous plan. Look at it in John 13, 27. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, "What you are going to do, do quickly." It's like he commands Judas. You've got your plans of conspiracy. Go do it and do it quickly. Jesus already knew of Judas's conspiracy with the religious leaders. He didn't try to stop him. He didn't send him off on some journey to Galilee to get him out of the way. He was like a command. You've conspired. It's been your idea. Get about your treachery and do it now. Then Jesus deliberately chooses a location where he would spend the rest of the evening with his disciples when they left the upper room. A location which Judas would know and expect. Look at John 18, 1 through 3. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now Jesus could have escaped that easy because he knew all about it. He could have said to Peter and James and John, to the disciples, he could have said, Judas will be taking the soldiers to Gethsemane. Come on, we're leaving to go to Galilee. We'll be safe there. Jesus deliberately went to the garden where he knew Judas would be bringing the authorities. People, you don't see a victim there. We see Jesus, the Son of God, in complete control. Jesus determined the place and time of his arrest. Secondly, we see in this passage that Jesus powerfully, confidently confronts the religious leaders and the soldiers in their imposing physical strength. I have a question for you that all of you can answer. We can all answer it in our heads. When you picture the arrest of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, what kind of group do you imagine arresting Jesus? How large was this group? I think most of us, the way I used to think was, well, there were 15 or 20 of people. But that's not what the gospel writers describe. In Luke 22:47, as Luke is describing this group that's coming with Judas, he says, there came a crowd. Now, the Greek word here for crowd is oklos. It's used in the Gospels to describe the great crowds that followed Jesus. Those crowds numbered hundreds, thousands. The word oklos does not use to describe a gathering of 20 or 30 people. If we put together Luke and John's record of this event, we see four groups of people that make up this crowd. Look at Luke 22:52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him. Just stay there for a minute. Look at those words. And go to John 18:3. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. So put those two passages together. There were chief priests, there were the official officers of the temple, there were the elders. Those men would be representing the Sanhedrin, many of them Pharisees. Then with these religious leaders were the temple police and a cohort of Roman soldiers. How do we know that? The term John uses that is translated a band of soldiers. You see it there? It says a band of soldiers. Well, the Greek word there is speran. It's used to describe a Roman military unit, usually a cohort. Now, a cohort was made up of 1,000 men, 760 foot soldiers, and 240 cavalry. The commander of a cohort was called Kiliarchos. That's the name that would be given anyone serving. He would, as head of a cohort, he would be the Kiliarchos. And it literally meant commander of 1,000. So look at John 18:12. So the band of soldiers, that's the cohort, Spirian, and their captain, that's Achilleorchus, and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. Now, were there that many people? Probably not. Spirian can also refer to a maniple. Now you say, why is this all important? Just be patient with me. We want to know this passage. I want you to know this passage well enough to go home and say, this is what it says every week. As we look at a passage, I want you to be able to go home. And so when someone says to you, well, what did you hear this morning? You can tell them. This is really impressive. A maniple, sometimes it's also a spearan. It was an auxiliary unit of a spearan, which would be made up of 60 or 200 men. Now, putting all that together, there were probably 60 to 200 Roman soldiers, plus a unit of the Jewish temple guard. There was a group of chief priests and a group of elders from the Sanhedrin. So there were 100, maybe up to 240 in that group, maybe more, arresting Jesus. These soldiers were well armed. The Roman soldiers carrying their short swords and the temple guards carrying their traditional war clubs. That's mentioned in the gospel narratives. Jesus and the disciples thus were vastly outnumbered. Maybe 20-1, maybe 30-1. But notice Jesus' response. He's not intimidated. Look at verse 4. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, whom do you seek? They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said, I am he. Now, again, we're going to get a little bit technical, but we have to, because you can't understand this passage unless we do. Jesus uses the Greek phrase, ego eimi. We've seen this at least 8 other times in sermons on the gospel. And some of you are saying, we have to go through this again? Yes, we do, because you have to know it here. And I asked about 4 people this week, independently, I asked them, about what this meant. And they didn't remember about ego eimi. So because of these 4 people, you're going to hear it again. We heard Jesus use this phrase, ego eimi, when he said, I am, ego eimi, the bread of life. I am the light of the world. In each of those Jesus uses the phrase ego eimi. Now, why does that matter? Well, he could have easily said eimi, which means I am. Ego eimi is a more intense form of eimi. It really is repetitious. It's saying I am who I am. I am that I am. Now, why is this important? The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is written in Hebrew. Well, there came a time when they said, we're going to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. And that's the Septuagint. Remember when Moses is at the burning bush and God has said, go back to Egypt. You're going to lead my people out of Egypt. And Moses doesn't want to have any part of this, and he starts making excuses. And he said, well, who shall I say you are? Who sent me? When they asked me, who sent you to do this? How can I tell them who you are? God said, you tell them, I am that I am has sent you. And he used the phrase in the Greek, in the Septuagint, the Greek phrase, is translated ego eimi. I am who I am. So we see Jesus used that phrase about himself all through the Gospel of John, over and over again. This is one reason the Pharisees hated him. They knew he was claiming to be God. And that's the phrase that Jesus uses here. Jesus asked, "Whom do you seek?" They answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "Ego eimi." It's translated in the ESV, the translation we use, as "I am he." Well, the pronoun "he" is not there in the Greek. Only "ego eimi." "I am who I am." Jesus could have said, "I am Jesus of Nazareth." He didn't. Once more, he's telling the Jewish authorities, "This is who I am. I am the God of Moses at the burning bush." And just as he had said previously that "I am the bread of life," "ego eimi," "I am the light of the world," "ego eimi," "I am the resurrection and the life," that was "ego eimi," "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And even when they came to arrest him, with all of this show of power, he boldly reminds them that they are arresting God. So you see this imposing force of soldiers. The disciples are scared spitless. But Jesus looks at them and says, "But do you know who I am?" Ego eimi. So Jesus determined the place and the time of his arrest. Jesus powerfully, confidently confronts the religious leaders and the soldiers in all of their imposing physical strength. Thirdly, we see here the voice and presence of Jesus, that it wrought a dramatic, astounding, and reverential response. The voice and presence of Jesus wrought a dramatic, astounding, and reverential response. Look at verse 6. This is the most amazing verse, people. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, many of the commentaries speak as if only the soldiers drew back and fell to the ground. That's not what the text says. It says they, and we've already seen that there were the chief priests, the officers of the temple, the elders, with all of these soldiers. John says the crowd drew back and fell to the ground. From the religious teachers and authorities to the battle-hardened soldiers of Rome. You've got to look at this and say, what happened? How did this happen? They were there to express their authority. They were there to arrest Jesus. And suddenly they fall back. John does not say anything about Jesus being transfigured before them like he was on the mountain, so that they saw his heavenly glory. He simply says Jesus spoke those holy words of identity, ego eimi. We've seen something like this before in John 6, the temple guards. The temple guards once were sent by the temple authorities to arrest Jesus. They had an arrest warrant. They were ordered to arrest him. And they come back empty-handed. And the authorities say, "Well, why did you not arrest him? Why didn't you bring him here?" What was their answer? "We never heard a man speak like this." They had retreated from him. Remember when he was in a boat with the disciples in a raging storm? Now, some of these disciples had fished all their lives on the Sea of Galilee. They had been through storms like this, but these men were terrified. They knew they were about to drowned. Jesus was asleep. That in itself was a testimony, not to him being tired, it was a testimony to the fact that he wasn't worried about the storm. They woke him. And he spoke. They said, "Don't you care that we're about to perish?" And Jesus just speaks, and there's no more storm. And what happened next? The disciples drew back, and we read that they were terrified. They had been terrified of the storm, but now they were terrified of this man who was in the boat with them, and they said, "Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him?" At least for very briefly, right there, they understood who Jesus was. I think this is one of those moments. We sang this morning of the incarnation of the Son of God in our hymn of adoration. Hark the herald angels. We make a great mistake by just limiting those hymns at Christmas. That's a hymn about the incarnation. That's the subject of the message this morning. That's why we went to that hymn. It says, "Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity." Now think for a brief moment. God gave them ears to hear. Ego eimi. Jesus was making one more time a claim to deity that he had made in every chapter. "Whom are you seeking?" "Jesus of Nazareth." And with the voice of God, the Son of God, Jesus said, "Ego eimi." Add to this. We miss this. We think that there were many of those soldiers that didn't have a clue as to who Jesus, anything about Jesus. Folks, Jesus was the most famous name, the most famous person in Israel at that time. Every member of the Sanhedrin knew of Jesus. The poorest of the poor knew of Jesus. Every blind, deaf, and paralyzed person in Israel, every leper knew Jesus. Pilate knew about Jesus. Herod, the debauched Herod, knew about Jesus. Pilate's wife knew about Jesus. They knew of his miracles. What would this Jesus do who could stop storms and raise the dead? What would he do with confronted by this military force? That was in their thoughts. He only had to speak, and for a brief moment, they bowed. They not only fell back, they fell to the ground. Does that look like a victim to you? Does that look like someone being churned and battered, killed by the gears of history? Jesus determined the place and time of his arrest. Jesus powerfully, confidently confronts the religious leaders and the soldiers and their imposing strength. The voice and presence of Jesus wrought a dramatic, astounding, and reverential response. Fourthly, and finally, Jesus overruled the willful actions of his own disciples, thus preserving their lives. In the middle of all of this, Jesus saved the lives of the disciples. These soldiers were well armed, carrying swords and some type of war clubs. This was an explosive situation, and it did explode. The impetuous Peter whipped out a sword and cut off the right ear of the servant of the high priest. Now, none of the disciples were trained soldiers. Peter, Andrew, James, and John were fishermen. They were severely outnumbered by a well-trained military force. Peter's impulsive and reckless action could have easily gotten all the disciples killed on the spot in a matter of a couple of minutes. You can just see every soldier reach for his sword. The disciples' safety was Jesus' greatest concern. Look at verse 8. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he, so if you seek me, let these men go." But what Jesus did when Peter cut off the man's ear, disarmed every soldier there. Jesus takes control of the situation by healing this servant of the high priest. This was a bloody mess. Soldiers drawing swords. Jesus quickly dials back the intensity of the moment by healing the servant. No more blood, no more wound, no more pain. And everyone there saw it. The soldiers were accustomed to the blood and gore of battle. But none of them had ever seen anything like this. This was Jesus' last miracle before the cross. It's revealing that Peter still did not understand. Even at this late time, he did not understand the identity and mission of Jesus. Matthew records that Jesus said to Peter, "Do you not understand, Peter? I can ask the Father, and he will send 12 legions of angels." That's 72,000 angels. The disciples were outnumbered. Jesus was not outnumbered. Now, Peter had confessed the identity of Jesus. We've seen it in Matthew 16 over and over again. "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." But at that moment, he had forgotten the power of Christ. He had forgotten the identity of Christ. And we can understand that because we do it all the time. Jesus was saying, "Peter, I am the Son of God. I don't need you to protect me, Peter. It's ludicrous for you to think that I need your sword." That's what he was saying. Well, Peter not only didn't understand the identity of Jesus at that moment, he didn't understand the mission of Jesus. Because what he refers in Matthew to the 72,000 angels, but he doesn't say that here. What does he say here? Look at verse 11. "So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?'" What's the cup? The cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's judgment. That's the cross. "Shall I not drink that cup? That's what I've come to do." Remember Matthew 16? I'm going to read it to you again. "From that time, from the time of Peter's confession, from that time Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go up to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day raised. And Peter took him aside," this was shocking, "and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you.' And he turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. For you're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on things of man.'" The first time Peter heard of the cruel death of Jesus, he rebuked Jesus for saying it. Jesus called the leader of his disciples Satan. Jesus repeatedly told his disciples about his death. We've seen it over and over and over again. But it was outside their frame of reference. So fast forward. Here's Peter just hours before the crucifixion, still standing in the way, still trying to stop the arrest and the trial of Jesus. Peter could only see that Jesus was becoming a victim of the power of the Sanhedrin, a victim of the power of Rome. Albert Schweitzer had some of the same view that Peter did. Jesus died a disillusioned lunatic on a Roman cross as a victim. This would-be Messiah got caught up in the powerful political, social, and religious machinations of Rome and Israel and Jerusalem. The gears of those powerful machines simply crushed him. No then, no now. Never. This was the Son of God. When his disciples tried to prevent his arrest, he rebuked them. "Do you know who I am?" He didn't need the angels of glory to wipe out the Roman Empire. He could have said one sentence. He could have said a word, and the Roman Empire would have disappeared. But Jesus was saying, "I'm going to drink the cup." Nothing could keep Jesus from the cross because of the will and plan and power of the Father and the Son. It was by the cross that the Prince of Heaven would destroy the power of evil. Do you think about this? Why did we sing that second hymn this morning? Rock of Ages cleft for me. We sang the great hymn praising the incarnation, the person of Christ. We sang that second hymn in praise of his mission. We would never be able to sing Rock of Ages cleft for me if he hadn't have gone to the cross. Jesus, slain, the Lamb of God, is our Rock of Ages. He wouldn't be the Rock of Ages. You see, it was a powerful act on his part. Not the act of a helpless victim. We sang of the power of Christ in that cross this morning. Oh, let me hide myself in thee. Well, how does this scene end? Look at verse 12. So the band of soldiers, and this is laughable. We say, who is he? He's the Son of God, come from glory. How does the scene end? So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and they bound him. I wish I could have been there. I really do. I would have probably run like the disciples, but knowing what I know, if I'd been there and could disappear immediately, and they were wrapping his hands in some kind of ropes, I would have looked and said, seriously? Really? Do you know who he is? And you're binding him with ropes. Could ropes hold him, restrict him? No. Was he outnumbered? No. They could have had 50,000 men. They could have had 1 million men, and he wouldn't have been outnumbered. What was Jesus doing? He was obeying the will of the Father. He was keeping a covenant he had made with the Father for the salvation of a fallen race. A covenant that had been made from eternity. Peter and the disciples' salvation was dependent on Jesus going to that cross. Jesus was not a victim of these wicked men in the garden. He wasn't a victim of these men at the trial. He wasn't a victim of these men when Pilate had him scourged. He wasn't a victim on the cross. He was in charge in all of those horrific events. There's so much more I want to say to you and apply, because this same Jesus, all of us go through horrific events, and this same Jesus reigns there with us. There's so much more, but that's for another Sunday. You know what we're going to do? We're going to stop and we're going to sing and worship. Join all the glorious names. We're going to sing and praise to this Jesus. Amen.